picture overview of our flight path to net zero. So essentially, if we did nothing, our emissions would continue to grow. We've got three main opportunities to influence this. There's kind of aircraft themselves, the technology of the aircraft and the operation of the aircraft. Then there's the fuels that we use to propel the aircraft. And then there's the out-of-sector solutions, which every pathway for aviation to get to net zero will need some out-of-sector carbon removals as well. So there's those three elements. So SAF is a very significant part of that. And by 2050, between 50 to 70% of our fuel use should be coming from sustainable aviation fuel. So it's a very significant part of our pathway to net zero. And I'd say the progress has been amazing in the last 10 years. Again, you know, working really closely with IAGs.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. I'm your host, Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying. Every Thursday, I have important conversations with top aviation executives, technology entrepreneurs, and policymakers helping aviation take climate action. Conversations that help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you are a frequent flyer or an airline executive, if you care about sustainability or simply love traveling, welcome aboard. My guest today is Carrie Harris. Carrie is the Director of Sustainability at British Airways, one of the world's largest airlines operating from London Heathrow, one of the largest hubs. How exactly is she working towards being more efficient? How is she working towards decarbonizing such a large airline? How is she communicating with 35,000 British Airways employees and a lot more customers? We talk about these issues and a lot more today. Enjoy the conversation. Carrie, great to see you again in person. And I'm so glad that we are doing this because I have been watching and learning from you and the British Airways journey around sustainability for the last few years. I think you started during COVID. So really excited to have you here as the Director of Sustainability for one of the world's largest and oldest airlines. Tell us, what does your role entail and is it overwhelming?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me here to this beautiful little podcast outlet in Little Venice in London. It is stunning. And just to let the listeners know where we're sitting, we're on a canal, kind of at eye level with the ducks, the coots and the moorhens floating by. So thank you very much for having me here.
We go the distance for our guests.
Yes, thank you. It's beautiful. So my role, so Director of Sustainability at BA, I can hardly believe it myself because it literally is my dream job. You know, my entire career has been focused on aviation sustainability and I've worked in all parts of the industry from airlines, air traffic control, and then previously at IAG and then into BA. So it's in my blood. You know, my general passion is as a true environmentalist, but also I love travel. So this job gives me the opportunity to try and unlock that particular challenge of trying to decarbonize aviation. So the role itself is very broad. It covers people, planet and responsible business. So on the people side, you know, it's really about engaging our colleagues in across we've got 40,000 colleagues now in BA, and helping them understand, be aware of their responsibilities and the role that they play in sustainability. But we also look after well-being and accessibility and colleague volunteering. And then on the planet side is obviously our action towards net zero, the climate program, but also a lot of work on waste, reducing food waste and single-use plastics, environmental compliance and all our reporting and disclosures. And then on the responsible business side, we do a lot of engagement there with customers, so corporate customers, individual customers throughout their whole journey, and also our whole community engagement program. So whether that's Flying Start, our partnership, our charity partnership with Comic Relief, or our work with Disasters Emergency Committee, or the Be a Better World Community Fund that we launched last year. So the program's extremely broad. And then in addition to that, we have obviously the governance and the transformation programs that run alongside that. So in a very large nutshell, that's it.
Wow, that is a very, very large nut that doesn't fit in the shell. So we will go through it one by one. You mentioned you're one of the few guests who has been in sustainability for most of your career. I have a lot of guests who have just moved into it from marketing, from finance, from legal. I have had airline CEOs who are taking this as one of the things that they're doing. How did you initially get into it? And when was that? What led you into sustainability?
Where it started, I went to university. I thought I wanted to be a journalist. I went to university to study English and psychology. And I bumped into my geography teacher after about 6 weeks. And I said to her, I can't do this. I can't read a Shakespeare play per day. What can I do? And she said, oh, you're really good at geography. Why don't you do that? So I switched to geography and biology and ended up studying environmental science. And I just fell in love with it. And, you know, for me, I think somebody once said to me, do what you love. And so there was no jobs in this at the time. You know, my family were like, what are you doing? There's no career in this. But I was like, well, I'll go with it and see what happens. And luckily, right by the end of my degree, the government had just started to introduce legislation about major planning approvals requiring environmental assessment. So I did a master's degree in environmental assessment. I think it was one of the first master's degrees.
I didn't know they existed.
Exactly. Yeah. We're talking 30 years ago. I just followed my nose really on what interested me and ended up pursuing this. And then it wasn't until 10 years after my career in aviation that I suddenly looked back and realized how it had all come together. Basically, I grew up with my father, who was an aviation fanatic. And so from a very young age, I've been going to air shows, you know, member of the local air club, but also a deep environmentalist. And so it actually probably wasn't a coincidence at all, but I thought it was. And I ended up in this industry. So, you know, the transformation in the last 30 years is incredible, and it's great to see where sustainability is at now, being so ingrained in kind of core corporate strategy. It's a dream come true, probably 30 years too late, sadly, but we are where we are. So now we need to crack on. Yeah.
Well, there's no such thing as too late. And I can really relate to this because I remember being told or asked by my parents once, how are you going to build a future? I have a technology background. I used to work with an MIT startup in Boston. And when I left to start Simply Flying, the first question was aviation. What do you know about aviation? And I said, nothing. I'm just very interested in it. But airlines don't pay well. I said, I'm not joining an airline tomorrow. And no. You know, there was just a lot of questions and I had no answers. That didn't help the cause at all. So I completely relate to this journey as well. You mentioned the BA Better World strategy. This is beyond just a net zero strategy for the airline. What is the BA Better World strategy?
So BA Better World is a sustainability program that we launched just over 2 years ago now. And really, it was on the back of 30 years of action on sustainability within BA. So it's over 30 years since we first reported our carbon footprint. I think we were the first airline to do so. We've had a community engagement program that's also been running for 3 decades. So we've done a lot of leadership in action well before this. If I kind of step back a bit, when I moved over to BA from IAG, we had then set the strategy at IAG for the whole group. So IAG International Airlines Group is the parent company of British Airways and includes other airlines of Iberia, Vueling, Aer Lingus and Level. So I was there for 5 years before I joined BA. And when we were there, we kind of set the group strategy, including the landmark announcement of our flight path to net zero, because we were the first global airline to commit to net zero.
When was this, Carrie?
That was 2019.
And IAG one was the first, or BA was one of the first.
IAG as for the whole group. So fantastic. We set that commitment for the entire group. So when we were there, the perspective was very much kind of regulatory investor engagement, group strategy and kind of group innovation through our Hangar 51 startup. And then when I moved to BA, so Sean Doyle, our CEO at BA, had started just a month before me. He recruited me into BA, and it was very clear from the outset, it was deep in the pandemic. It was a horrible time for the aviation industry. But, you know, thanks to Sean's leadership and the space that he gave me in those kind of early months in the role, we were able to do a huge amount of engagement with the management committee and to really set out our top five priorities, strategic priorities, which include sustainability as a core part of our corporate strategy. So Be a Better World basically embodies that principle of sustainability being ingrained as part of our strategy. And it was really to set a landmark, to show the commitment and to set out what we meant by sustainability and how we were going to engage our people in that. So it was super exciting time. We had a really fantastic launch event in the hangar at Heathrow with our beautiful Be a Better World branded aircraft, which now has its very own Instagram page and followers around the world, which I love. But really, that was just a symbol to show, you know, what the commitment means to us. And the strapline on the side of the plane, I think, says it all. It's Be a Better World. Welcome on board our most important journey ever, which I just still love to see flying around.
I love the branding around it. I love the tagline. It's something so relatable and so natural. I am quite an airline livery geek, and I love liveries. I'm curious about the backstory. Why did you decide to go with an entire aircraft with the BA Better World livery? I think it's in light blue and white tones, which is not the BA traditional colors.
Yeah.
Why a special livery for this aircraft?
Well, I mean, BA's got a history of doing special liveries for special occasions. And, you know, when I was thinking about how we can make a mark that shows how importantly we're taking this, I thought, what better way than through our best vehicle to showcase what we're about is our aircraft. So it was an initial idea. It seemed like madness, but I have to say Airbus really helped us with it. And again, you know, it was during very difficult times during the pandemic, but we partnered with Airbus and we managed to bring it to fruition. But, you know, the whole logistics behind it were incredible. And even the day before, when we had the world's media already coming to the hangar, we still were waiting for it to come on time. So it was literally the paint was drying as we unveiled it, and it looked beautiful.
Luckily, you did not have to put wet paint do not touch stickers on a plane.
No, it was lovely. But we had to bring it in under darkness because so many people, there's plane spotters everywhere. And somebody did see it just before, but they didn't spoil the surprise. So yeah, I just think I loved the branding as well. And did, you know, right now I flew out of Heathrow a couple of weeks ago. We're continuing to use that livery. So we've now got electric buses, airside electric cars and small electric scooters. So I looked out the plane window and I could see the Be a Better World aircraft, the Be a Better World fleet on the ground. I was like, this is exciting.
Nice. You're seeing the fruits of your labor on the ramp.
Yeah, it's just a visual reminder of kind of what the commitment is. And it's good for our colleagues and our customers to see.
So is this aircraft more than just a special livery? Is this a platform? For example, I know Etihad Airways, I have had their CEO on the podcast. He told me about the Etihad Greenliner, which is a platform they're doing with Boeing on the 787 and testing SAF and doing a lot of green initiatives. Is this aircraft just a livery or is this a platform?
So the reason we selected that one is because it's one of our A320neo aircraft. And in 2010, so while I worked at NATS, we did a flight in partnership with British Airways, which we called the Perfect Flight. And the idea was in 2010 to showcase the opportunity available for flight efficiency. And at that time, we flew a flight from Heathrow to Edinburgh and we collaborated right across the system. So from Heathrow Airport to the air traffic control, to the people on the ground at Edinburgh and with BA and the pilots on board. And we showed that basically that flight was able to save, I think it was around 20% improvement on emissions performance versus typical flights on that route at the time. So the BA Better World aircraft was 11 years on from that, so almost a decade on, more than a decade on. And we wanted to show what change had been delivered in that time. Because I think for most people, they look at aircraft, they don't look much different than they did even 30 years ago. But so much innovation is going on behind the scenes that's not always visible. And we wanted to showcase that. So the A320neo aircraft was the first aircraft of its type that we had in our fleet. So that particular one, TTNA. And we basically operated it with sustainable aviation fuel on board. We were purchasing offsets to go along with the flight. We again collaborated with ATC and did optimum climb, cruise and descent procedures and then electric operations on the ground. And what we showed is that flight in 2021 overall had 60% reduction in emissions compared to the one that we'd done 11 years earlier. And so that was really exciting to see. And there's a video about that on our BA Better World YouTube channel. The feedback on that is great because, as I said, usually most of this is hidden from view. And, you know, a lot of the innovations in, say, the aerodynamics of the aircraft, wingtips, etc., and the A320 aircraft itself, as well as then the operational practice, just went together to bring about that, including our electric pushback tugs on the ground, etc. So that's why we selected that aircraft. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. I had no idea about this backstory, so I really appreciate you sharing this. From what I'm learning from you, you seem to have a lot of stakeholders. While the BA Better World aircraft is often seen by customers like me on the ramp or by media or people external to British Airways, it seems that you are working with a lot of stakeholders within the airline as well. So you mentioned the employees and the stakeholders. Who are these audiences and do you cater to them in different ways?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, huge amount of stakeholders, and I've touched on them, you know, from our kind of our shareholders, our investors, our regulators, our customers, our colleagues, and we treat the planet like a stakeholder as well. And so for our colleagues internally, for me, they're super important because this is a group of like 40,000 people. If we can inform them about the opportunities with sustainability and get them to kind of help be kind of ambassadors for us and help us drive the change, that, you know, we can't do it alone as a small central sustainability team. So we need everyone in our business to be working together. And we kind of track this and have been tracking engagement, awareness and engagement in sustainability since before we launched BA Better World. And it's really exciting because we've seen a tripling in the awareness and engagement. And it's quite a high bar that we set. So we ask people if they understand BA Better World and the role that they play in it. And we've gone from kind of 17% to 60% in the last 2.5.
What is it that you've done? What do you think are the one or two things that have really tipped the scales here?
I'm not sure if it's one single thing, but it's, you know, we have an incredible internal comms team. We have an amazing internal intranet site, RBA. And so there's so much material on there, but we run events. We have kind of roadshows, workshops, podcasts. We've tried to reach out in a number of different ways to people because, you know, our colleagues are mobile, they're flying, they're all over the world. So we try and think about different ways to reach them. And with our community fund project, for example, we've given every single colleague a £20 voucher twice a year to contribute to the charities and the causes that appeal to them on our community fund. So we've run BA Better World Awards events to try and recognise the people that have really stepped up and shown leadership and willing to show what best practice looks like and encourage more of it. So, you know, a lot of colleague recognition, rewards and thank yous to those who are leading. And then recently we had an amazing day, which to me kind of shows great commitment, I think, from the leadership team in BA, where we took 200 of our most senior leaders in the business for an entire day to focus on sustainability.
Wow.
And it was, you know, a deep education process about the perspective from global sustainability and the challenge, the climate crisis that's facing our society. And then through detail of how we're managing climate within the business, a bit of education, and then a big focus on what individually everyone can do in the business and how sustainability is everyone's job. And I suppose that's my message to everyone in BA is, you know, this is all of our collective responsibility.
Wow. Is this something that you think you'll be doing often? There's 200 top leaders on an annual basis.
And much as I'd love to, I don't think we can do it very often. But, you know, I think it was the feedback from it was extremely positive. And the important thing with that is that they are the leaders who can then enable their teams to take action. And there's so much goodwill and motivation and desire to be involved that these people are the key to unlocking that and giving the permissions for people to just, you know, put their ideas into action.
Right.
So, yeah, it was great.
Wow, this is quite exciting. So you've addressed the internal stakeholder, which is the employees and the leadership. What about customers? I remember you and I first interacted when I was trying to fly from Vancouver to Dubai. And the most fuel-efficient way to fly was on BA, which was better than a nonstop flight from Seattle, because it was an Emirates A380. BA was using the new 787 and the A350, most fuel-efficient. And then when I went through the website, I was offered the choose option. No, I was told about the choose option to offset, but I couldn't do it in the booking path. But in the end, you helped me to figure out how to offset my flight, and I did manage to do it. Is that a core part of the value proposition for the customer? How does that all fit in?
Yeah, so, you know, part of our plan has been looking at the customer experience kind of end to end through the journey and trying to weave sustainability in that, right, from the booking, time of booking, through the airport on the aircraft. And so our platform collaborates. So we have been offering various options on how to either offset or contribute to climate projects for over 10 years now. And it's a constant kind of feedback loop and evolution of trying to find what is the right product, what resonates with customers, and what is kind of environmentally the most rigorous product to offer. So last year we launched Collaborate, so that's CO2, Collaborate, platform, which for the first time kind of offered a platform for customers to select sustainable aviation fuel, as well as the first ever certified carbon removal credits. And I was like super excited about having those options on there for customers. And for, you know, the team who have been introducing this, they saw like an overnight doubling in engagement in that from our customers.
When you say engagement, were these people buying it?
Oh,
or
yeah,
these
buying
people
it. Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, it's still relatively small uptake, but of those who are taking part and choosing one of these products, 40% are selecting sustainable aviation fuel, even though it's several times more expensive. So it really shows that for those people who do want to take action, kind of, you know, keeping the insector and related to aviation impacts is really important. So we've done a lot of consumer insights and we keep kind of evolving that platform and thinking about, you know, how we can tweak it, how we can do more and just make it easier for people to use. But it's the feedback's been really good so far.
I'm glad to for you and thank you for sharing, because I did not know that people who are choosing would choose to, you know, 40% of them would actually go for SAF, because it is 3 to 5 to sometimes 10 times more expensive based on where you're flying.
Yeah.
Let's talk about SAF and sustainable aviation fuels. How do sustainable aviation fuels fit in to the BA strategy? Because you have a lot of existing airplanes which will be flying up till 2040, 2050. They will need sustainable aviation fuel to meet both the EU mandates as well as your own targets. Where does SAF fit in?
So, big picture overview of our flight path to net zero. So essentially, if we did nothing, our emissions would continue to grow. We've got three main opportunities to influence this. There's kind of aircraft themselves, the technology of the aircraft and the operation of the aircraft. Then there's the fuels that we use to propel the aircraft. And then there's the out-of-sector solutions, which every pathway for aviation to get to net zero will need some out-of-sector carbon removals as well. So there's those three elements. So SAF is a very significant part of that. And by 2050, between 50 to 70% of our fuel use should be coming from sustainable aviation fuel. So it's a very significant part of our pathway to net zero. And I'd say the progress has been amazing in the last 10 years. Again, you know, working really closely with IAG. So Jonathan Lee and Jim working at IAG, their action on SAF. They have been working on this for over 15 years. You know, true pioneering action and innovation, going from raw concept where it didn't even know if it was possible to now where we've got thousands of flights and it's basically coming by pipeline into our operation at BA every day. So, you know, we made a commitment to 10% SAF. So this was part of the IAG group commitment, was to have 10% SAF across the whole group by 2030. And already kind of over $800 million of investment gone in to secure that so far. So for BA, we're now operating about 1% of our total fuel use now comes from sustainable aviation fuel.
This is out of Heathrow or globally?
That's globally, but vast majority of that is out of Heathrow. And most of it comes through the pipeline from our Phillips 66 plant up in Humberside. So, you know, that in itself is kind of pioneering breakthrough and super exciting. And I think, you know, globally, the availability of SAF is still less than 0.5% of what aviation needs. So we're pleased to be at 1%, but obviously we've got a long way to go to reach 10% by 2030. But we've got a lot of new plants coming on stream as well. So I mentioned the Phillips 66 one that we're currently drawing from in the UK. And that's basically used cooking oil type fuel. We've got a new plant, which again is like first of a kind technology, which is working with LanzaJet in Georgia, their Freedom Pines facility. And that'll start early next year. So we'll be taking a really significant supply from them into our New York JFK operation. And then if that technology, then that first of a kind technology is proven to work, we can then apply that for our Nova Pangaea project in the UK, which just super exciting.
And what are the SAF pathways for these? Is it mostly biofuels? Is there any eSAF here? Is there any PTL?
So they're different. So as I said, the Phillips 66 is used cooking oil. The LanzaJet one is alcohol to jet fuel. So that's why it's pioneering. It's the first to kind of do that, you know, ethanol alcohol to jet fuel. And then in the future, we'll have other plants that we're looking at as well with power to liquid. So, you know, first, second and third generation sustainable aviation fuels. We're looking at them all and we will need all of them to help us reach that 10% target.
You mentioned how the SAF strategy was pioneered out of IAG at the group level. How do you coordinate? Is all the SAF for the group airlines ordered by IAG and then you just take what's ordered? What kind of inputs do you have in this?
Yeah, so the IAG team look after some of the top level targets, so like the sustainable aviation fuel target. And exactly as you described there, the team there do the sourcing and most of the contract negotiation on SAF. Super, you know, global experts working on that. And I'm so grateful for all the work that they do. So they do that sourcing and then we would then be working with our customers, so corporate customers and individual customers to look at, you know, where they've got interest. So obviously we want it for our own operations, but the great thing about sustainable aviation fuel is the way that it's credited within the UK ETS means that for our corporate customers, they can also purchase sustainable aviation fuel for their scope 3 emissions mitigation. And we're seeing, you know, real strong interest from our customers in that, both for cargo and kind of for our commercial flying.
And is that done out of your office and
yes.
your team?
Okay. Yes. So, yeah, we have a team dedicated to the kind of carbon products. Yeah.
Okay. So you are seeing a good corporate uptake. What is the regulatory framework here in the UK? Because you're the first UK airline I'm having on the show, obviously. We know the EU mandates are there. Does the local UK framework help you? And if so, how?
So basically, we've had a lot of support from the UK government, a lot of pioneering support, you know, firstly in the commitment to net zero, and then in the support for sustainable aviation fuel and some of the funding that we've had for that. So we do have backing and we do have kind of the high level intent from the UK government. And then we have the Jet Zero Council as well, which has been great at mobilising groups on sustainable aviation fuel and zero emissions flight. So, you know, it's great that we have that momentum. What we're seeing though is when we look globally, in the US, they have the Inflation Reduction Act, where it's offering incredible incentives and really accelerated the investment into sustainable aviation fuels. And I think the incentives that now exist there mean that US airlines are able to access SAF at pretty much price parity with fossil fuels. Whereas for us, we still have a significant price premium in the UK. And it's a similar situation with Europe, where some of the European policy is also kind of offering incentives and a feedback loop so that the revenues raised through the EU emissions trading system, for example, are being fed back into innovation and investment to reduce emissions from aviation. And that's kind of some of the thinking that we'd like to see more of in the UK to help drive the investment into more SAF plants and accelerate that, because the technology is there now, the will is there, but we just need to unlock the investment and to give investors that confidence that they can take that leap to invest so we can scale it up. So we need a bit more support. We have got the UK mandate, which is really welcome, and the government are going to be consulting more on the kind of intricacies of how that's designed and the different fuels that are incentivized within that. So there's, you know, we're working really closely with government and still a bit to go to make sure that we get the scale up as fast as we need it. Yeah.
I do wish you all the best. You mentioned the Jet Zero Council. I think that's unique to the UK. Can you tell us a little bit more about this council and what's your role in there?
Yeah, so I think it's been running just over a couple of years now. So basically, the transport and the energy secretaries for the UK, so central government backed, and really trying to bring together all parts of the industry. So there's airlines, airports, ATC, manufacturers, and academic institutions all around the table working with government departments to look at how we can deliver net zero for aviation. And at the moment, there's a sustainable aviation fuels group and a zero emission flight group, and just about to be a non-CO2 group as well, which kind of cuts across between the two of them. So, yeah, I mean, we're seeing really good momentum coming out of that. We had a fantastic event with that group last week in Bristol, which was hosted by Airbus, bringing together everyone from the Zero Emissions Flight Group to look at kind of what are the priorities for the next few years. And I think what that's helping do is just keep this. I mean, the last few years, there's been so much proliferation of research and different bodies doing, looking into different elements of it. There's probably some duplication in areas. And so I think the Jet Zero Council is helping to kind of have that oversight and pull together some of it, and the learning, help share that learning and best practice. And so we can hopefully move forward faster. So yeah, that event last week was really great at kind of identifying what the priorities are for the next few years and kind of got us all focused on what needs to happen by 2028, which is great.
Right. I'm glad to see this cross-sector collaboration. One of the ways I've seen airlines around the world collaborating is or looking at is intermodality. Some airlines are open to it, you know, take a train for a part of the journey or an electric car, for example, and then take a flight. Is this something that BA has on its radar?
Well, I think we've long been asking for better rail links into Heathrow. I mean, we've got the Heathrow Express now, which is great. It would be great to have a Western connection. I think it's definitely more that we could do. It's not an area we're deeply involved in. But I think, you know, in the UK, it's super contentious now with HS2, for example. And I think, you know, on the topic of zero emission flight, I think when you look at the pace of development in that, it's, you know, highly likely that we'll have, you know, true, you know, ultra low or zero emission flight operating within the next 15 years. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, without the land take, the biodiversity, the community severance and the cost that exists for high-speed rail. So, you know, who knows, maybe we'll be delivering that before some of the high-speed rail is ready, and then we'll have that kind of direct connectivity with the regions, which would be great.
I'm definitely going to be watching the space, because that's been the one big change for me moving from Canada to London, where there are trains everywhere. You take a train everywhere. I had not stepped on a train for years up until I moved here. And, you know, it's been very convenient. of course, for short journeys of an hour or two maximum, which is very different from taking a flight. UK is also much smaller than Canada is.
Yeah.
So I'm very curious to see how this evolves. You mentioned things that you're doing earlier, like, you know, single engine taxi and operational efficiencies. Can you, now this is an easy win because you can work on operation efficiencies tomorrow. You don't have to wait for SAF to come in. You don't need to wait for new hydrogen aircraft or infrastructure to be built. What are you doing in this regard?
So this is like I love operational efficiency because I think while we're all focused on the future, exciting, you know, like big shiny future solutions like, you know, hydrogen propulsion or SAF, I think we have a, you know, deep obligation to make sure that we're minimizing emissions here and now as much as possible. And I think the opportunities are absolutely massive. So when I worked at NATS, I could see, you know, looking across the whole sector, you get that literally kind of, you know, more than bird's eye view, space view of the Earth and where the inefficiencies are across UK airspace in particular. And so the opportunities are massive for efficiency improvements. And we've made a lot of changes on this over the years. So, you know, working really closely with our operations team, we've put in place, like you said, so all of our ground operations now are running on 100% renewable electricity, which means that when we plug the aircraft in on stand, they're immediately using renewables rather than fossil fuels from the small auxiliary power unit in the tail of the engine. So we're moving to that as much as possible to make sure that the aircraft on stand are using that renewable energy instead of fossil fuels. And we've introduced motor torque pushback tugs, which are electric pushback tugs instead of the big heavy diesel ones. I mentioned earlier about some of the buses and the electric buses and the ground fleet that we're introducing. And we're also making sure that all the diesel vehicles that we do still have operating outside are operating on HVO fuel, which is essentially like biofuels for ground fleet. So those are all happening. And then we're also working with our flight crews to make sure that they're kind of integrating flight efficiency into pilot training. And as part of our program for BA Better World, we actually just appointed two project pilots specifically to deal with engaging pilots on flight efficiency. And they've seen a massive shift in kind of awareness and engagement, 22% improvement to that same metric that I mentioned before, just in the last 6 months after appointing them. And, you know, direct fuel savings and emission savings as a result of that. So I think it's super exciting. When we look at the opportunity that pilots have individually, so some of the work we were doing a few weeks ago showed for the average person in the UK, they, you know, a carbon footprint may be about 10 tons, 9 or 10 tons of CO2 per year. But the unique thing for our pilots is because they are in control of this aircraft, which, you know, is reliant on fossil fuels. For pilots who operate with sustainability in mind and who think about their pushback, their holding, their single engine taxiing, you know, climbing efficiently, cruising at optimum levels. For pilots who do that, they have the potential to influence up to 4,000 to 5,000 tons of CO2 per year. So It's, you know, I think that can be incredibly motivating for pilots to engage them in this and to show how they can be a really big part of the solution in helping us be more efficient here and now.
This is very interesting. I go back to an earlier part of the conversation. You mentioned in 2010, you were at NATS and you did this test flight with British Airways, which is now your aircraft, the BA Better World. How many of these things that you tested back in 2010 are regularly applied today on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, lots of them actually. So, you know, when I was at NATS, we did a lot of work with military airspace. So looking at, so, you know, civil aircraft basically for a long time were kind of taken secondary position compared to military, and military would book airspace for their exercises, and for whatever reason, sometimes it wouldn't be used and then wouldn't be cancelled, and civil aircraft were then having to fly around that airspace. So I know that NATS have done a huge amount of work with UK military to try and improve that procedure. So if it's not needed, it's given back to civil, and then airlines can then fly more direct routes more efficiently. But, you know, right through from the flight planning process, the kind of fuel planning that's needed for the standard departure and arrival routes, there's hundreds of changes that NATS have made across the UK that airlines can now kind of take advantage of and save on a day-to-day basis. And I think, yeah, what's gone from initial concept is now routine operation. So just need that constant iteration.
Now, operation efficiencies are all good because you as an airline can track it. But as a customer, what are some of the initiatives I can see next time I board a BA flight? And in full disclosure, when I was living in Vancouver, I think I'd flown BA twice in the last 5 years. And of course, since moving to London, BA offers a lot more options and many more direct flights than others. So I've had a chance to fly you a bit more often. What can I expect as a customer in the cabin?
In the cabin, what can you see? So, well, touching on our flight efficiency, I mean, when our customers are on board the plane, if they look out and see the other aircraft next to them with a great big yellow hose plugged in underneath, that's the preconditioned air unit. That means that the small engine in the tail of the aircraft is, you know, probably not being used. And the preconditioned air then is coming from renewable electricity to keep the cabin cool.
Ah, that's what it is. Okay,
yes.
So you're not burning fuel on the ground, you're saving fuel and it's plugged into electricity. Is that the APU?
Yes. Yeah. The preconditioned air is the yellow tube and the APU is the auxiliary power unit at the back of the aircraft.
Got it.
And then with fixed electrical ground power together, all of those can help, you know, save a huge amount of emissions when the aircraft's on stand. And in terms of other things that passengers can listen out for is when they're taxiing out. So one of our key things we ask our pilots to do is, when possible, is to taxi out using only one of the engines to save fuel. And then when they're in the holding queue waiting for departure, you might sometimes hear the thing. Sometimes people get scared because they hear a noise that sounds like a barking dog.
On the Airbus aircraft, specifically?
Yes, yeah. And that's basically the pressure build up to start the second engine. So when you hear that, it's fuel saving, it's emissions reductions techniques that are in practice. So it's a great sign and a good sign and something we want to encourage. And then, you know, elsewhere on board the aircraft, we're really thinking about all the products that we're using on board and working with our cabin crew and the onboard experience to help reduce waste and specifically single-use plastics. And, you know, that's a big part of our program, which we've made a lot of progress with already. So a lot of for long-haul flights, our blankets, we're removing or have already removed the plastic wrapping that went around the blankets. So it's now paper banded. The headsets, we're removing the plastic. And so overall, there's kind of more than 100 tons of, you know, plastic that's been removed, which is millions of individual items of plastic removed, but we've still got more to do. So that's really a big focus for us in the next couple of years, is looking elsewhere at where we can get alternatives to single-use plastics. And it's super complex for aviation because we need something that's lightweight so you don't burn extra fuel. We need it very space conscious, very time conscious for the cabin. And we need to think about kind of reuse and segregation. But our cabin crew are doing an amazing job. And we actually just did, I don't know if you read about this recently, we just did the first ever recycling into New York. So cabin recycling is hugely constrained on what can be done due to international catering waste regulations. And it means that any product that's come into contact with animal byproducts, so milk, for example, if it comes in, we cannot recycle it. It has to be kind of landfilled or incinerated due to international catering waste regulations. And we've just managed to be the first airline ever to kind of work with the regulators around that to try and prove that safe segregation can be done on our trial operating into JFK in New York. And it's been really successful. So now we're working with IATA to help roll that out. And the opportunity there to help reduce waste at a massive scale is really exciting.
Wow. I can see all of my senses being engaged here. You know, I'm not smelling the jet fuel because of the yellow tube plugged in. I'm hearing the barking dog, and I know that that's fuel efficiency. I'm smelling the food waste being separated. I'm looking at the plastic not going on. I love how this is a sensory engagement. You should make this part of your branding video as well. Look out for this.
Love it.
on VA. You mentioned earlier, and I'm curious about this, how customers are given the choice for offsetting CO2, and many of them are doing with SAF. Customers are now obviously seeing a lot of measures being taken on board. How much do you think this is the customer's responsibility to reduce their footprint versus the airline's responsibility?
I think first and foremost, it sits with the airlines. I think we have to do it. And we've done a lot of consumer market research to ask this. And I know from being a consumer with other brands, you know, when you select a brand, you select it on the basis that you expect them to be taking action. And sometimes you're happy to pay a premium for that to make sure that your brands align with your own values. And it's exactly the same for flying. And I think that's the responsibility we have, is to make sure that we're acting, you know, in our own interest. We want to do this. We want to do it for the future of our airline. We want to do it for the future of the planet. But we also want to do it because we know it's what our customers want. And they do tell us. And, you know, for example, in relation to single-use plastic, it's probably one of the comments that we get back is if we're not doing well on a particular flight, then we'll get feedback saying, you know, why is this still here? So we have to explain the process that we're going through. So, yeah, I think first and foremost, it sits with the airline. But then I think we do have a responsibility to inform our passengers about the climate impact associated with flying and to give them options if they want to, and then how to mitigate that. And that's what we're doing with our SAF and our carbon removals options on Collaborate.
Okay, so I'm guessing you're focusing as much as possible on transparency, bringing the options, putting the options out there. One final question, which is not often discussed around airline sustainability, but I'm learning a lot more about, which is non-CO2 impact, warming impact on the climate. What are you doing in terms of contrails, in terms of NOx and other non-CO2 emissions?
So non-CO2 is a really fast growing area of interest. I mean, it's been researched for decades, but I think there's kind of coalescing now around the sense that absolutely it's crucially important. And actually, if anything, the impact of contrails we're now understanding is probably bigger than what was previously estimated. So I think there's more to do in terms of understanding the absolute impact, and that may vary for different airlines depending on where they fly. What we know is that certain contrails at night, for example, long duration at nighttime will have much more of a warming effect than, say, short duration in the daytime. So it matters where and when the contrails are formed. And also we need then to develop the contrail prediction technology and then think about how we mitigate. And so we are already working on all of those areas. We've got a great research project going on with Breakthrough Energy and with Imperial College in London that's given us some insight into being able to predict kind of where the key contrail formation is for our network and understand kind of which flights of ours are most likely to be causing contrails. And it's fascinating because what we're seeing is probably 10% of the flights have the contrails that are likely to have most impact. So actually it can be quite targeted in how we measure that and how we mitigate it. And potentially sustainable aviation fuel, as you touched on there, could be, you know, a double whammy solution to this. So, you know, it's got, you know, life cycle emissions reductions of say around 80% versus fossil fuel, but then an opportunity also because it's got less particulates and soot in it to significantly reduce the contrail formation as a result. So that's a real focus of current research to understand that opportunity too.
Okay. Well, that's the one part I can't look behind my window and see if there's a contrail being formed or not. Not yet, unless you install those really cool cameras.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can see them. This has been a fantastic conversation. I've learned so much, Carrie. The final round of this interview is what I call the rapid fire round.
Okay, go for it.
If you've heard the previous interviews, you know, it's where we have a bit of fun. We get to know you a bit more personally. And I'll ask simple one-line questions. You can give me one word or short phrase.
Okay, so,
for example, what's your favorite movie?
Top Gun.
Okay, I'm in. Maverick or the original?
I love both of them, but the original's the one that I've watched too many times to admit to.
I remember watching Maverick once again on my last flight, and I was whistling the tune as I walked out of the flight, and I was getting knowing glances from the flight crew in the train that you take, and then I realized I became conscious, like, oops, yeah, okay.
I've seen you watch that before.
What about your favorite book?
Oh, I love Where the Crawdads Sing. It's so beautiful. It's you know, it's set in the US. It's the descriptions of nature. I love it. It's beautiful book. Yeah,
very, very interesting. You might enjoy another nature type of book, which is called Braiding Sweetgrass. It's a Canadian bestseller, and it's written by an Indian or a native person, and about their traditions of living in nature.
That sounds
braiding
amazing.
Sweetgrass.
I'm going to read it. Love it.
It's going to be a good one. What is your favorite city?
This is so hard. I don't know. I need to pick one. I'm going to say Edinburgh because it's so unique, and I love going back there. I'm not from Edinburgh, but I just love it. The setting with the castle, the atmosphere, the people, it's magic.
It's beautiful. Yeah, it's like being transported into another era, the Victorian times or something. It's quite charming. What is something you like to do in your free time?
My favorite things, being on my horse, roaming the countryside. That's me.
You ride horses?
Place. Yeah.
Very interesting. And do you have horses?
I have a horse. Most people got a lockdown puppy. I got a lockdown pony.
Wow.
So yeah, lifetime ambition. Thought, yeah, now or never. So yeah.
One of the most fascinating facts I learned after moving to London was it is legal to ride a horse in the city. Have you done that before?
I've ridden through streets and towns, but not in London.
Wow. This is very fascinating. I do hope to come meet your pony or
do.
A horse.
Yes, do. Come
sometime.
See her. Yeah.
My daughter is really into horses these days, so this will
Excellent.
Be fascinating.
Bring her out. Yeah.
What is something you want to learn?
Well, here's my claim to fame. I took part in BA's charity BA Does Strictly earlier this year. I'm actually reigning Strictly Queen. It's for our Strictly Come Dancing. And actually, I really loved enjoying that dancing. I'd love to do a bit more contemporary dance. It was good fun.
You're a dancer too?
I'm not really, but I just took part for fun and by pure chance happened to win, which was crazy. But yeah, so I did ABBA. Yeah. It was hilarious. But
wow.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, so I'd like to do a bit more.
I think we have to move on from Britain's Got Talent to BA's Got Talent.
We've already got that. And people have. It's incredible. Last year, we had people playing the piano and making cocktails at the same time. I mean, the talent is amazing. So all of that's for comic relief as well. And we raised like over £50,000. It was magic. Yeah.
Congratulations. I love how many times you've mentioned the word magic. Because it's truly emotive. You feel it. If you were on an 18-hour flight, let's say from London to Sydney, who would you choose as your seat partner? And this can be someone living or not living.
Okay. This is probably so wrong to say. I just watched a Netflix documentary, so I wouldn't mind sitting next to David Beckham. Sorry, Victoria.
Is this the one where he's in Brazil in the Amazon?
No, this is the one that's kind of reflecting on his life. It's,
okay.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Probably shouldn't have admitted that. But actually, it would be nice to have 18 hours on the flight with my husband. We don't get enough time together. So
hey, you
it
chose,
would mean
you,
we'd carved out
you
time.
Chose Beckham here.
Oh
so
my
let,
God, I'm going to be in trouble.
You've chosen Beckham here.
I'm
so just for the record, he was the first one who came to mind. And finally, if we are speaking a year from now and we are popping champagne, what are we celebrating?
My ultimate hope is that we get global economy-wide carbon pricing. So literally a carbon price on every single product that people purchase. And I think that would drive the behavior shift that's needed overnight. So I don't think it's going to happen in the next year, but if it did, I'd definitely pop champagne with you. So
fantastic. Well, to that, thank you very much, and I really enjoyed speaking.
Thanks so much. I loved it too. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air. aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize industries. Yet, there are multiple paths to get to net zero. Awareness is key to a green future. So please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing this episode on your network, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or even WhatsApp. Or perhaps you might consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this episode. You can start a conversation with us by writing to us at podcast@simplifying.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website green.simplifying.com and join the movement. Sustainability in the Air is an original podcast by Simplifying. The show is produced by Juraj Toth in Slovakia. Dirk Singer is our Director of Sustainability, who leads research for each interviewee out of Greenwich, UK. Shubhadeep Pal is our supervising editor based out of Mumbai and Singapore. The articles are written by Ayushi Badola in Dehradun in India and Mira Hull in Montreal, Quebec. Creative design is led by Ligia Esteve in Montreal. Baiba Dreamen is the project director for the show based out of Valencia, Spain. Special thanks to Wendy Sim in Singapore. And I'm Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simplifying and your host. Please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.